Coming to you from our studios in Dallas, Texas, and recorded live, Science News is on the air right now.
This is the promise of tomorrow, where people and industry keep up with the business of emerging and nanotechnologies. The fields covered in this series of programs will include energy, defense, aerospace, medicine, semiconductors, and more. For the next hour, Colonel Mason will introduce his experts, and you'll be on the cutting edge of the promise of tomorrow.
And it's just so good to have you back with us again as we explore the exciting world of the business of emerging science, nanotechnology, open innovation. And we're going to talk some more about the IEEE Homeland Security Technologies Conference that's going on November 12th through the 14th in Boston. And it's a very exciting conference. We try to give coverage to that every year. And this year, the opening keynote speaker is Daniel M. Gerstein. He's the Deputy Undersecretary for Science and Technology for the Department of Homeland Security. Fascinating guy. He's been on the program before, and he's coming back again to tell us about the book he has written on the national security and arms control in the age of biotechnology, the Biological and Toxin Weapons Convention. The book essentially details the history of the Biological and Toxin Weapons Convention, a controversial arms agreement drafted in the 1970s, meant to supplement the Geneva Protocol for warfare from decades earlier. The treaty banned the use of biological weapons in modern warfare, but it failed to ban their development, transport, or trafficking. So there's big holes in that conference, and he's going to tell us about that. Exciting there. And in just a minute or so, I'm going to introduce you to Madhu Barawal. She's the CEO of IEM, and the technology that Madhu will be presenting at the IEEE Homeland Security Technology Conference is a thing called WebPuff. WebPuff, yes, a web-based emergency management decision support system that helps emergency managers make quick, informed decisions about how best to protect the public in the event of chemical emergency. We get a chemical spill or something, you know, on purpose from a terrorist, like what has been going on in Syria, and WebPuff will tell the direction that that is in the most danger and when people can come out. It's a fascinating thing. You're going to enjoy hearing all about that. And, of course, we're going to visit the Den of Strangers, get more wisdom from somebody a lot of us never heard of, visit our fountain of useless information we have here on the set, and, of course, at the end of the program, listener comments and the voice of reason. Those of you listening on radio, remind you, you can also hear us commercial-free online at promiseoftomorrow.biz, where it's webcast. All right, now to today's guest.
Stand by.
Right now, I want to introduce you to a really interesting guest that we have with us today, Madhu Barawal. She's the CEO of IEM. That's a technology that Madhu is going to be presenting at the IEEE Homeland Security Conference, and it's called WebPuff. And I don't know much about it, but we're going to find out more here. It's a web-based emergency management decision support system that helps emergency managers make quick decisions to protect us in the event of a chemical emergency. So welcome to the program, Madhu.
Thank you, Colonel.
Now, I understand that the Army and FEMA have been using this WebPuff since 2004, when it was fielded at sites in the United States where chemical weapons are stored. So what new are you? First of all, tell us what WebPuff does, and then what is going to be new that you're going to be presenting at the conference?
Well, WebPuff really helps the Army and the civilian authorities keep people safe. And the way it does that is that if there's an accident that occurs at any of these sites where chemical weapons are stored, mm-hmm. The Army and the civilian authorities can basically figure out where the plume of a chemical agent would go, and so who needs to be evacuated or sheltered in place. So it takes the information on the release of the agent, you know, if it's sarin or VX or mustard, and then basically projects that forward based on the topography and the weather to see where, how far the effects of that release would go.
Okay, now, since 2004, I guess this could generate a chemical plume prediction in less than 2 minutes, and that's fast enough for support emergency response, and it's the only model that does that. Is that something that you've improved since 2004, or what makes it different from when it was first introduced?
Well, I think that's one of the key things when you have emergency response. You really have a balance between sophistication of the modeling, the computations inside, as well as the speed of the modeling. So you can run computations that can be very much more intense, but it may take 24 hours to run it on a supercomputer. Well, that would not protect people.
Mm-hmm.
So to make sure that people are protected, you have to be able to run the model itself within a five-minute window, which is the criteria, which is the requirement that the Army has, that you must be able to run it within a five-minute window. And the requirement that we've met since 2004 is that it generates the plume prediction in less than 2 minutes to allow people to then absorb the information, make a decision based on that, and then project that forward, let the people know that there's an area of risk.
All right, so when the chemical accident occurs, or if it's even done maliciously, this generates a plume, and the prevailing winds and weather determine where this plume is going to go and how it's going to put people in risk. And what happens with web puff is you're going to be able to predict who's going to be in danger and for how long a period of time. That's the essence of this, is that right?
Yes, exactly. So what happens is that, let's say that an accident occurs and the chemical is released into the air, the invisible plume of this chemical agent starts to disperse out based on the atmospheric conditions. So based on the prevailing winds and based on things like moisture, the wind speed, number of different weather parameters have an effect on how quickly the chemical agent starts to disperse. So what WebPuff does, which is also pretty interesting, is that it just doesn't take the current weather, it also takes the forecast weather, because you're interested in where it's going to be in the future as much as you are interested in where is it right now.
Yeah.
And taking forecast weather is very important, because if you don't take the forecast weather, you're basically implying that the weather doesn't change.
Yeah.
Is not true.
Sure.
The weather will be changing, in effect, over the course of time. It may take several hours for it to disperse, and you need forecast weather data for those several hours to be able to say where the plume might be in the future, so who would be at risk at that point. And so it takes this information on the weather, and it has to take information on the topography. Certainly if there is a very large mountain in between, the plume would not act the same way as if there's flat terrain.
Mm-hmm.
So prior to 2004, the models that were available were essentially flat terrain. It assumed that there's no topography in the way.
Oh, wow.
And in that case, it over-predicts what would happen on the other side of the mountain.
Well, sure.
And then under-predicts what would happen on the side of the mountain facing where the release occurs.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not accurate to not have topography in there. WebPuff has both the topography of the location as well as uses forecast weather data as well as current weather data from weather towers that are on the Army installations.
Okay, and the other thing, it calculates and provides the optimal time for people to exit a shelter. What is this, that if residents don't exit a shelter at the right time at some point, the concentration of chemicals inside the shelter will be greater than the concentration outside the shelter? Now, how does that happen?
Well, there really was, when an accident occurs, there are two ways to protect people. Either if you have enough time and you can evacuate the people and they can get out of there before the plume actually arrives in that location, that's one way to protect people. In a lot of cases, it is better to actually shelter people in place. And what's meant by that is that people go inside their homes, they shut down the heating and air conditioning systems, because that's going to draw air from the outside. So you want to shut the HVAC system down and tape the doors and windows to prevent leakage of air from the outside coming in.
Mm-hmm.
So now you've sort of created this as much of a sealed environment as you can. Despite that, there is still some leakage of air from the outside into the structure. So when people are sheltered there, if they are not asked to leave at the right time, then the concentration over time inside becomes as high as the concentration had been outside. So it's very important to get people not only into the shelter at the right time, but then actually get them out of the shelter at the right time. And WebPuff is one of the few models that actually calculates this shelter exit time to figure out when people should be exiting various shelters, so that information can be provided to people, and people are asked to leave the shelter at the right time.
I can see how this is really quite a tool. Now, FEMA needs it, of course, and of course it was developed for the United States Army. I'm going to ask you some more about that in just a minute. But who should have this tool? The fire departments and different municipalities? And, I mean, should this be something that should be standard equipment at every city around the country? Or is it enough that local FEMA agencies can have this tool?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, the tool was developed for chemical weapons. So when we're talking about chemical weapons, it's like sarin, which is, by the way, the chemical agent that we expect has been used in Syria recently,
mm-hmm.
or VX or mustard. But WebPuff also has the capability to model toxic industrial chemicals, so common everyday chemicals that are transported across the country or developed and produced at chemical plants. So it has the ability to model the release of those chemical substances also. So certainly WebPuff can be used and should be used, or something like this technology should be used by fire departments and police departments and emergency managers when they make a decision on whether they should evacuate a community or whether they should shelter a community and when they should exit those people that are in shelters.
Yeah, I mean, we transport a lot of dangerous chemicals by rail, and I suppose other means, and of course accidents can occur, I suppose, with chlorine gas, with all sorts of different things. And I would think that as a matter of preparedness, almost like, well, like having a fire extinguisher, you never want to have to use it, but you're sure glad that it's there in case you do. So this is something that seems to be, ought to be standard equipment in fire departments around the country. How many municipalities and how many industrial places are currently have WebPuff on hand?
Well, WebPuff is right now used primarily in the chemical weapons arena. So this is used particularly for chemical weapons. This is one of the only four models that are approved by the Department of Defense for use in chemical weapons modeling. So it's been primarily used in that context. But certainly it can be used in the context of fire departments. Like you're saying, you use a fire extinguisher, as you have it as an insurance, and you use it to douse the fire if it occurs. This is a tool that actually extends your ability to decide appropriately what needs to be done. So it's sort of a fire extinguisher for the brain, I guess.
Yeah. Now, let me ask you. I mean, we've pretty well covered the chemicals, and it makes a lot of sense. But what about something like what happened with Fukushima, where you've got nuclear fallout and these other things like that? Could it be used in the nuclear industry?
Some of the atmospheric dispersion algorithms are similar. You know, how you model the transport of a neutral gas, essentially,
mm-hmm.
is the same. However, when you model a nuclear event, you have to account for the particular kind of substance that's being emitted. So if we wanted to use WebPuff for something like a nuclear power plant accident, it would need some modifications, but it can be done.
Okay. You developed this originally for the Army. And tell us how that happened. The Army come to you and knock on your door and says, hey, we need this kind of tool. Can you put it together? How did it happen that your organization, IEM, developed this for the U.S. Army?
Well, we have been working with the Army and the FEMA for about 20 years on the chemical weapons program, and we were doing most of the training for the precursor to WebPOP, which was a product called D2 POP. Mm-hmm. It was actually developed on the DOS system, the old Microsoft DOS system, and it was a line-based program where you had to answer questions to be able to run it. Then if you made a mistake, you had to start over again. And so it was not very user-friendly, and some of the algorithms inside had to be updated. And the Army recognized that we had scientific expertise at the company, mm-hmm. as well as programming expertise, okay. and that we understood the internal mathematics of this model quite well, and asked us to develop a version that would be web-based so that it would be easy to use by emergency managers. And also they asked us for it to be open source, because there's a lot of licensing fees being paid for all the different parts of this model. Uh-huh. And we created a 100% open source version that relies on OpenGIS, oh. for the Geographic Information System,
okay.
and a open source relational database, as well as all other components of the model are open source. So there's no licensing fee that has to be paid to anyone for the use of the WebPOP model.
All right, so the only way that you make your money is by selling the your license itself to use WebPOP, but you don't have to, nobody has to pay multiple license fees to other people who have developed their own tools that might integrate with this. Is that what you're saying?
That's exactly it. So you're paying just one license, and you're not paying for underlying component licenses. Mm-hmm. If you are using other proprietary technology underneath, then you'd be paying licenses for all of those also. And we also try to use other data standards like the EDXL Common Alerting Protocol standard. Mm-hmm. Our scientists have been involved in the development of this Common Alerting Protocol. And what that does is that once you decide that this area is at risk and you need to tell these people to either evacuate or shelter in place, you need to get this warning to them. And the warning is sent perhaps, let's say, siren systems or emergency alert systems, phone alert systems that you send this warning through. The Common Alerting Protocol allows you to take that polygon that defines who is at risk and be able to directly send that to any kind of CAP-enabled device, which will know and be able to interpret what area you're talking about and be immediately ready to alert those people.
Mm-hmm.
So this is another place where you shorten the time that you need to be able to take the action you need to take, which is basically from this software, from WebPOP, letting the sirens and the tone alert radios know exactly which area you're talking about so that they can provide the warning to people.
And you had mentioned the sarin gas that we think is what has been used in Syria. And of course, Syria's got a lot of neighbors with Turkey and with Israel and other places like that. And they decide to turn some of that gas on their neighbors in some sort of retaliation or warfare. I would think this tool would be pretty handy. Are you working with foreign governments to get this tool into the hands of our allies?
Well, this is technology that is sensitive, but certainly it would be something that would be available to allies of the United States.
So you say it's sensitive, but it will be available to the allies, but it's not currently, is that right?
It's not currently available to the allies of the United States.
All right, but you could provide it, let's say the Boston Fire Department decides they want to acquire the tool. Could you sell it to them?
Absolutely.
Okay, so you could sell it domestically, you just cannot sell it overseas. Is that what you're telling me?
There's some concern with selling it overseas, but it will have to go through the right channels for a export capability.
Okay. You're going to be speaking at the IEEE Homeland Security Technology Conference going on in the middle of November. We're going to look forward to seeing you there. And after you make that presentation, what do you hope will be the takeaway? What do you want people to hear you? What do you want them to go away with in their minds?
I think that the most important thing to me is that to save people and to keep them safe, it's important to use these technologies to figure out who's at risk and be able to do it in a timely fashion with great accuracy, and use that information then to make the right protective action decisions. You had mentioned the Fukushima disaster. This technology has been available, as we mentioned, WebPuff has been available since 2004, but we really are facing a situation where people are not as comfortable using these technologies and relying on these tools to be able to make the decisions they need to make. So I really think it's important to underlie decisions that are made on who should be protected, how they should be protected, using the best information that we have at hand. WebPuff is the best information we have at hand on what to do in a chemical disaster.
All right. Madhu, would you kind of put on the meditation cap here for just a minute, if you don't mind? Kind of look down the road, maybe 5 years or 10 years or something, and maybe give us a prediction. Do you have an insight into the future? What do you see going on either in the United States or around the world or something down the road a bit?
Well, if you look to predict into the future, you should look at the past first. So let's look at the past. We were focused on natural hazards, and then we had 9/11, and then we started worrying about terrorism, and then we got Katrina. And after we said, okay, let's worry about hurricanes and terrorism, then we had the BP oil spill. And so the things that tend to occur are not things necessarily that we're looking at. And we in the United States, we have almost completely destroyed all of the chemical weapons stockpile that we had over the years as a part of the treaty with Russia and with the Chemical Weapons Convention. But moving forward, what we are seeing is that there are states and nations that are using chemical weapons now against their own civilians and potentially against others. And so my prediction for the future would be that we are going to see more chemical weapons and bioweapons attack than what we have seen in the past. And that this has been something that we worried about for a while and then kind of said, well, it didn't happen, it may not happen. But I think we are now much more vulnerable than we have been in the past.
Okay. Have you been marketing this commercially to people like the Boston Fire Department or Dallas or communities around the country, or do you intend to move in that direction now vigorously, and how do you plan to do it?
Yeah, I think we are planning to move more vigorously in that direction now because we believe that the timing is right for people to understand that these technologies can be very effective in protecting people.
Well, you've been a fascinating guest, and this is something that I had never considered, and I just love it when we come up with something new like this. So, Madhu Bharwal, the CEO of IEM, thank you immensely for being with us today. Thank you so much.
You're quite welcome. This is actually my second radio program here in 2 weeks, I think. So it's fascinating to do these radio interviews. I much prefer them, actually, to television, where you're worrying about how you're looking.
Oh, absolutely. So where was the other radio interview?
It was on WUNC, the NPR affiliate here in Raleigh-Durham, and they have a program called The State of Things.
All right. That's great. Well, thanks so much.
Thank you very much, Carl Mason. Pleasure speaking with you.
All right. You too. Thank you, Madhu. Okay, as we walk to the break at the half hour, we're going to pause at the door of the Den of Strangers, where we keep locked away all of the wisdom of mankind. In the Den of Strangers will we meet today?
The old sage of New England. So, this is dear old Boston, home of the bean and the cod. where the Lowells speak only to the Cabots, and the Cabots speak only with God.